הפרק בחסות רשת אינבסטור 360. רשת הפודקאסטים המובילה בישראל בתחום הפיננסים וההשקעות.
הופק ונערך על ידי שמע, פודקאסטים ויצירות סאונד.
מעוניינים ללמוד יותר על עולם ההשקעות? הזינו לפודקאסטים נוספים שלנו. המשקיענים, אבנר סטפאק ועומר רבינוביץ' מדברים על כל מה שחם בעולם ההשקעות בשווקים המובילים וגם ההזדמנויות בשווקים המתפתחים. אינבסטור 360 לייב. אורן ברסקי ועומר רבינוביץ' מארחים את בחירי שוק ההון ועולם ההשקעות. כסף חדש עם כל מה שרציתם לדעת על עולמות הקריפטו והפינטק, והפודקאסט השקעות למתחילים לכל מי שעושה את צעדיו הראשונים בעולם ההשקעות.
שלום, ני האו, כאן יובל ויינרב מלהבין את סין, הערוץ שלכם לכל מה שצריך לדעת על המעצמה שתעצב את המאה ה-21. להבין את סין הוא חלק מרשת הפודקאסטים של אינבסטור 360, הרשת המובילה בישראל לתחום הפיננסים וההשקעות. הפרק הזה הוא פרק מיוחד. דבר ראשון, כי זה הפרק הראשון אי פעם באנגלית. מצד אחד עמכם הסליחה, מצד שני האופציה הנוספת הייתה לעשות אותו בסינית, אז אני מניח שעדיין עדיף אנגלית. והסיבה לזה שיש לנו פרק באנגלית היא כי הייתה לי היום הזכות לארח בהמשך לפרק שהיה הקודם עם מתן וילנאי, שהוא היה הנשיא של אוניברסיטת UIBE, אוניברסיטה הסינית הבינלאומית לכלכלה ומנהל עסקים והשלוחה שלה פה בישראל, זה שבעצם דרך זה קיבלנו את הזכות לארח את פרופסור ג'ון גונג, שהוא סגן הנשיא של השלוחה הישראלית של האוניברסיטה למחקר ואסטרטגיה, אבל הוא גם פרופסור מאוד מכובד לכלכלה בסין, ב-UIBE בסין, שכאמור זו אחת האוניברסיטאות המובילות שם בתחום, ומדובר בבן אדם עם סט של קרדנצ'לס מהמרשימים ביותר שאתם יכולים לדמיין. הוא מייעץ לרשות להגבלים עסקיים הסינית, הוא היה מעורב בכמה מהתביעות הכי משמעותיות של הגבלים העסקיים בשנים האחרונות, הוא עבד בהרבה מאוד פרויקטים וחברות ברמות הכי גבוהות, גם בסין, גם מחוץ לסין, בארצות הברית, בקרן המטבע העולמית, בהמון דברים. בקיצור, איש מלא ידע ומלא ניסיון ומלא תובנות, וזה היה הזדמנות שלא יכולנו לפספס לארח אותו כאן, ולתת לכם לשמוע ישר מאחד האנשים שהכי מבינים בתחום הזה, קצת על הכלכלה הסינית, דיברנו על מגזר הבנקאות, הפיננסים, כל בנקאות הצללים, כמו שידועה, שדו בנקינג בסין, על הרגולציה של הממשל בשנה האחרונה, על נושא הדאטה, לנסות להבין מאיפה זה בא, איך זה עובד, מה כיוון המחשבה. אני חושב שהיה פרק מרתק, אני מאוד מאוד נהניתי בשיחה איתו, ואני מקווה שגם אתם תהנו. אז הנה, מתחילים. Ni hao, hello, shalom, and welcome to Professor John Gong that we have the honor to have you here tonight. Thanks a lot for coming over.
Shalom, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. So, Professor, really, for me, it's a great honor to have you here. I think it's an incredible opportunity also to all of our listeners to hear from you, which really are one of the best people I could ask to come here for a lot of different topics.
And, thank you very much.
I think we can do a series of episodes on all the things that we can cover together, but we try to focus today on a few topics that I think that are very interesting, and I tried to select topics that I think that are pretty much completely misunderstood here in Israel in terms of how the Chinese economy and specifically the Chinese banking and finance systems work, and some of the reasons behind the recent regulations and changes and reforms in China. So we'll try to cover all that today. But to start, maybe can you tell us a little bit about your vast professional background, if
okay.
that's okay.
Well, again, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a great pleasure to be here. My name is John Gong. I'm originally a professor. I'm still a professor at a university located in Beijing called University of International Business and Economics. And the university, we think of ourselves as sort of the Chinese version of the London School of Economics, LSE. Yep. We're one of the best in that area. Now, in terms of my personal background, I was educated in the United States. I went to University of Texas at Austin. I got my PhD degree there. And I started my career there. I spent the next 14, 15 years in the United States, first in New Jersey working for Bell Labs for about mm-hmm. 7 years. And later I moved to Colorado, state of Colorado, much better place. I started to work in the cable television industry. Worked for a company called Cable Television Lab. The work I did there was mostly related to sort of economic regulatory analysis. And when I started the work with Cable Labs, it's becoming more like a technology oriented. I was in the strategic assessment, strategic planning department for the whole cable industry within that company. The company was sponsored by the whole cable industry in the United States. So I was really exposed to the technology stuff. And I worked there for another 7 years and decided to go back to China. I went back to my alma mater. That's the university I graduated from. I started as an associate professor there, and after a few years was promoted to full professor. And then in 2019, we started this venture here. We have a partner here. We started this, what's called a UIB. UIB is the abbreviation for University of International Business and Economics. So we have a branch institution here called mm-hmm. UIBE Israel that is located in Petah Tikva. We have been operating for about one semester, and when I enter the second semester, we have 27 students altogether is the first year. It's not bad, as I understand it, compared to other new universities, the first year in Israel.
Maybe to mention, and this is something I learned in the last episode when I spoke with Matan, who's the president of the university.
Our president. Right.
And shout out to him and the team that they introduced me to you and allowed us to have this this episode recorded. But it's important to say that the university was actually beginning its registration well after the registration for most universities started last year. So it was, even 27 is a very good number considering that you started registering them a few weeks before the semester started.
I would characterize this as we are blessed. I mean, we got our license from the Higher Education Commission here in Israel in late July.
Yeah.
And we officially opened in the first or second week of August, and we start recruiting students. And you know, last year, the bulk of September is all holiday. It was all holiday. So I'm very happy. I'm very happy with our current status. We're expanding. We are filing for more programs with the CHE, Commission of Higher Education. Mm-hmm. We are recruiting students. Also, we're going to recruit some more students from China this year. The next academic year. So I'm very excited about our future here.
I said this even in the previous episode when I heard about all the details. I think what you're doing is exceptional. And I think that for students that want to really understand China in general, but more specifically in the business and economy sense, the opportunity to study in UIB Israel is exceptional because it really gets you the information from Chinese professors like you, of course, also from Israeli professors, but the fact that you have this mix and you have the ability to learn straight from the point of view of the Chinese about their economy and their business as a student, and you learn Chinese, and you have Chinese students that you can interact with, which is something that I was really missing when I studied Chinese in the university 15 years ago in Israel. I think all this comprises a very unique experience that can be...
Absolutely. Thank you very much. But I just want to add one more note. In addition to the traditional programs we offer at UIB, you know, in business and economics area, we aspire to be going well beyond just as acting as a business school. We're venturing into other disciplines as well. In computer science, for example, we're going to file with the CHE computer science program and some other programs too, like, in the current planning, we're thinking about like environmental studies, stuff like that. So we're going to have some more programs down the road.
That's great. So good luck with that. I'm rooting for your venture and hope it all goes well. So really, let's take this opportunity, Professor Gong, for trying to have the Israeli audience a bit more familiar with the Chinese economy, and more specifically, because I said this in the opening, but your very extensive background also in practice and working in a lot of these fields in China, maybe starting with, let's try to understand the Chinese banking system, the banking system of China, which is a bit different from what people in Israel or the States would be used to. And maybe can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. So let's first talk about the commercial banking sector. Look, we have to keep in mind that the recent banking industry grew from a sort of a Soviet Union style planned economy in the past. Yeah. That's when Mr. Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978, and the country started this open door policy, you know, opening up and also reform policies, right? Yeah. Before that, basically China has essentially there's one bank. That's the China Commercial Industrial Bank. And there's a couple of other much, much smaller sort of rural communal banks or cooperatives. So system grew out from there. So gradually, when Deng came to power, we started to open up the banking sector. They established several, the largest, still today, the largest state-owned banks. There are five of them. These are the big names you probably have heard of with the China name in it. China Construction Bank, China, I think, Agricultural Bank, Bank of China, a couple of them, five of them altogether. But gradually over the years, there are more new financial institutions established. Some of them are sort of city-based banks. Some of them are transformed from sort of rural cooperatives into agricultural banks catering to the rural community. But let me say the following. I would say the bulk of the banking industry in China is still very much highly regulated. That's first. And second thing is that the state ownership still takes a very large share. If you look at the entire landscape, I mean, there are a few banks that are publicly listed companies with, you know, private ownership, but the bulk of it are still very much state-owned banks. Yeah. The largest are central government-owned banks, and there are some smaller ones that are municipal government or provincial government-owned banks. Yeah. That's the overall picture. Now, having said that, I would still say that the competition is quite stiff. It's a very intense competition in China. Much, much intensive than in Israel. I'll put it this way, okay?
That's true.
Because through my own experience, I know that. Because, just to go to a branch in Israel is quite an exercise. You know, you have to make an appointment and all that. But usually in China, there are, you know, in any geographical markets, there were at least I would say 5-6 banks competing. It's a very competitive landscape. And also, let me make a note. In addition to this, we are starting to see these big tech companies. You heard about Tencent and Alibaba, right? Yeah. They have these financial, you know, settlement systems, but practically they're getting to the consumer retail banking business, actually. So there's actually a lot of pressure, competitive pressure from the big tech companies.
That's a great point that you raise, and we'll actually touch on that in more details later on when we go to talk about regulation. But That's true, because what you said, and this is fascinating, I think, for the Israeli audience, the fact that these are state-owned banks, at least in a significant majority of them, doesn't mean that there is no competition. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that it's only a structured market where it's clear, you know, one big bank control everything. There is a lot of competition, that's true. Right. And I think that you touched another very good point, that is the fact that these banks, you know, traditionally, and even, you know, when I first came to China, I remember that waiting in line in the bank was not horrible. A fun experience.
Yeah, it was horrible. Yeah.
It could take long time, but mm-hmm. because of this pressure from these tech companies, mm-hmm. they kind of force the big old banks to adapt and to modernize and to offer things that are a more accessible customer experience, let's say.
No, I know what you're talking about. Actually, I got the same experience when I first went back to China in 2009. So, I know usually, when I was in the United States, usually the bank tellers are waiting for customers. So But in China, it was entirely different at the time. But things are actually rapidly changing.
Yeah.
These days, that kind of a scene, you're seeing mm-hmm. people lining up in the lobby of a bank. I think it's increasingly disappearing because of new technology, because of increased competition. And I think most importantly, I think it's really moving towards the digital banking direction. Even the ATM machines in China, they're mm-hmm. having a business problem. In other words,
nobody uses cash anymore.
Yeah, people are not using ATM machines anymore. So that's a rapidly changing what's going on in China right now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And again, we'll touch on the mm-hmm. on digital payments in a second, but for me, you know, I really felt it after I used to live in China, and after I came back to Israel, I used to go to China roughly every month.
Oh, really?
For work mostly.
Okay.
And one thing I noticed is how rapidly, you know, in 2010 or 2011, I could do everything with cash and it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. In 2018 or 19, if you go into a taxi and you have cash with you, he would look at you like, oh my God, what does this person wants from me? This foreigner again without digital payments.
In these days, as a foreigner, without an app on your handset, it's even difficult to get a taxi on the streets in Beijing, right?
It is. I used to, a lot of time, you know, I used to have my friends, mm-hmm. like my local friends, call the taxi from me, like order it from Didi call a taxi.
I see.
And I just would just write based on that and maybe I repay them or whatever. Yeah. So in terms really of the structure, you mentioned a few different types of banks, but mm-hmm. if we try to understand the role, for example, of the central bank, the mm-hmm. PBOC, the People's mm-hmm. Bank of China, and then under it, the big commercial banks and under them, you know, really the municipal and local level banks.
Right.
What type of role in the economy do you think that each of the banks play?
I think the different roles they play is really in terms of the scale of operation. I mean, these big banks are typically have national footprints. They operate on a national scale. Whereas those, municipal government owned banks or provincial government owned banks, these are more of a regional players. And also I think in terms of the customer base they're catering to, that these big banks usually cater to very large institutions, very large companies, huge state-owned companies, big companies, whereas these smaller banks would cater to smaller customers, clients, small companies, medium or micro companies, and their loan business are also probably more geared towards that customer base. And in terms of the nature of the operation, I think they're more or less the same. I mean, commercial banking is commercial banking, mm-hmm. attracting deposits, making loans. That fundamental business is still there.
Okay. And when we look at, for example, there is another element that's often referred to, especially in Western media, about the shadow banking mm-hmm. industry mm-hmm. in China. How would you define that or explain that to our audience in terms of the role it plays? And
okay, so where does the shadow banking come from? It really comes from a fundamental problem, that is the small and micro businesses have immense difficulties of accessing capital. I think it's a problem probably not just in China, probably everywhere around the world, that small businesses are having difficulties of getting loans because they don't have much collateral, for example. They don't have well-established probably accounting record, stuff like that. I mean, commercial banks have certain standards, and it's kind of difficult to meet these standards. What's unique in China is that the family bonds are very strong. Not just the family, I mean the bonds between relatives, for example, and also between members of the villages,
communities.
Because in China, it's very much driven by the same set of families sharing the same last name. I mean, you can go to a village, for example, in China, where probably 80% of the households in that village have the same last name.
Right.
So if you trace back the ancestors, probably they're from the same family or something. So I would call these as a societal bonds or family bonds or relative bonds are pretty strong. And that's where this kind of a landing come from. So in other words, small entrepreneurs have difficulty trying to get capital from ordinary channels, from banks. They would just appeal to these people. They promise some kind of a return, right? That's, I think, the beginning of the shadow banking. What's interesting to see is that in a strict legal sense, this is actually illegal. China's financial law, banking law says that you have to have a license, right, to attract deposits. Okay, so this kind of a business is really sort of informal. And I think for many years, the Chinese government hasn't really gone after this kind of a business unless you run into a problem. In other words, you attracted so much capital that you were not able to pay, and that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Then the government, went after you, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I think over the time, this has grown to the extent that some people, think about not just of this from this perspective of trying to get some more capital to run his business. They view this as a business.
Trying to be
like a bank, right?
Yeah.
And that, I think, crosses the line. I mean, you're becoming like a financial institution and you're trying to attract deposits sort of illegally.
It's not an honest community bond like you described before, but it turns into something that's commercial by its nature as first priority.
Exactly. And they're also promising very high interest rates, returns that are totally impractical to be realized. Okay, so in other words, the boundary between sort of attracting legitimate funds, private funds, and run a Ponzi scheme, basically, right?
Yeah.
So I think this boundary is kind of not that difficult to cross. Once you start to get into this business, you want to grow. You're promising ever more, ever higher interest rate returns, and all of a sudden you found yourself in a Ponzi scheme that you can't be sustainable again, and then you got into legal troubles. Okay, I think that's the problem. So this kind of a phenomenon has been going on for quite a few years, and I think the more recent form of this kind of a shadow banking is what we call P2P.
Borrowing and lending.
When
it became really like, instead of a small community thing, it suddenly became like a platform where everybody could do this.
So there are a lot of activities like this in the last few years. And I think today...
But the Chinese government pretty much shut it down completely a few years ago.
Right. Since a few years ago, the government started to shut it down because it's growing out of control. In many cases of funds, disappearing, people disappearing,
A lot of ripoffs and schemes.
Right, exactly.
That's true. That's very interesting. And when we think about really how the Chinese government see shadow banking today, so you explained that very well. Is it true, if we're referring to the point that you've mentioned before, that in a way, when we think about Ant Group or Tencent payments, mm-hmm. WeChat Pay and similar platforms, mm-hmm. in a way, all the recent regulations that we saw that says, okay, guys, you're not a tech company, you're mm-hmm. a finance company, and right. you're doing what banks do, so you need to be regulated as right. such as well.
Right.
Is that kind of like a view of the government that sees these things becoming like shadow banks in a way that just grew into proportions that are bigger than a lot of yeah. the of yeah.
so,
other banks?
Well, I think what the government's perspective is that these type of business models have to be on the same footing with the traditional commercial banks. In other words, it's fundamentally it's a attracting deposit and making loan business. So mm-hmm. it has to be subject to the same type of regulations. The tech industry, you know, tends to have a different perspective. They think it's high tech, it's internet, it's revolutionary things, right?
Yeah.
They came from this perspective, but I think what the actions have clearly demonstrated that the government doesn't think like that, especially I think, you know, starting from the towards the end of last year, remember, that the Chinese government started to regulate these high-tech companies.
Yeah.
And they didn't allow Ant's Finance, right, to go IPO.
Yeah.
And I think mostly coming from that concern.
I actually had an episode in the podcast specifically about that, and it grew so much, it brought so much comments and mm-hmm. and I got feedback from people that really didn't know it, because you know, the way it was portrayed in Western media mm-hmm. is, oh, the Chinese government didn't like something Jack Ma said, so now they're hitting an Ant Financial to in spite, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. And I told them, listen guys, you know, think about a company that makes more loans than most banks do.
Exactly.
But instead of having like 30% capital relative to their investment, to their loans or whatever, they have like 2 or 3%.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
On this point, let me try to put things into perspective. We all know Alibaba is a very large company, but we have to, you know, think about what does that mean, okay? Mm-hmm. Alibaba occupies about 70% of China's e-commerce space.
Yeah.
And China's e-commerce space is about 20% of the total retail market, okay?
Yeah.
So what it really means is that Alibaba itself, just one company itself, mm-hmm. controls about 14% of the entire retail market in China
yeah.
for 1.4 billion people, for
Amazing.
Everything, for almost everything, okay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They sell practically everything, right?
That's
so it's
true.
A huge, huge market. And they try to leverage that market control into venturing into other things. Settlement, advertising, for example, consumer credit. That's
yeah.
a huge business, consumer
yeah.
credit, right? So it's getting into sort of tangential businesses, mm-hmm. and it can do that pretty easily because it has the antitrust, we call it market dominant status.
Yeah.
So it's trying
yeah.
to leverage in its core market dominant status in the e-commerce business into branching into other areas.
Yeah.
And that could be, you know, in my view, as an antitrust economist, that sounds
yeah.
pretty scary to me, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a really the rationale behind Chinese government, taking an antitrust stance against these few companies, particularly in the banking sector.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely something that, again, for me made a lot of sense. I think when I tried to explain it, and you explained it, of course, even better. But when I explained some of the logic behind it, I said, oh, you know what? This actually makes sense. It doesn't look anymore like it's, you know, just like, oh, they didn't like some speech that he said, so, you know, they decided to go after his company.
Yeah.
It's much more complex than that. And
right.
it's really risk assessment and risk handling that is actually the responsible thing for the government to do when it thinks about the projection of the economy in the future. And in that regards, really, it would be good to address the entire massive regulation wave that we saw in China in the last year, let's say, or so.
Mm-hmm.
I you know, I have kind of like a way that I help myself and sometimes others understand this. The thing this is, there are a few types of regulations or regulations that try to address specific kind of problems in the Chinese economy and society, which are, of course, intertwined. One of them is the classic anti-monopolistic behavior prevention, let's say, and making sure that companies don't have too much power that they exploit. And the other thing is really the side of financial stability. So besides just having, let's say, the too much control in one company, trying to identify areas that can cause financial instability for the entire economy. Right. So that can be speculating assets like cryptocurrency, or it can be the financial lending companies like we've mentioned. Another one that is more on data, and that one I think we'll touch in a section of its own because it's really a very interesting topic. And the other one is, are things that are more, let's say, social priorities, or trying to structure a better harmonious society. And in that regards, I can look at things, you know, like the some of the regulation that we saw about the gaming for minors or things like that. And but these are, you know, four different buckets that a lot of time intertwine and act together as a global strategy, let's say. So if we look at all these regulations that happened in the past year, can you try to help us understand, Professor Gong, how do you see that relates to specific elements that are mentioned?
Okay, this is a very good question, actually. I think you mentioned two things, two set of issues. One is sort of antitrust, anti-monopoly kind of issues. Yep. The second one is sort of regulation against things that are related to society, right? Like gaming, that kind of thing. Let me try to address each one. In terms of anti-monopoly issues, the one thing, because I'm actually very familiar with this industry, I've been involved in antitrust litigations and, you know, on the government committees to assess mergers controls, that kind of thing. So I'm actually totally familiar with the entire history of China's antitrust law enforcement, which started in 2008. This is the year when I returned to China. So I remember that. The law was passed in that year. Now, there's a fairly amount of, antitrust development in China. But one thing that really hasn't done anything, in my view, by the authority, is antitrust actions against the entire internet sector. Because the entire regulatory or competition authority, their entire philosophy over the years, up until, you know, what we saw the action since last year, before that, they always have this mindset that this is sort of like a Schumpeterian industry. It's what we call a dynamic competition phenomenon. Companies come and go. Regulation, antitrust enforcement has to be very cautious. They always has this kind of a mentality. So I would say up until 2021, 2020 time, there's practically no antitrust actions, practically almost none, against these very large companies. Now, today we are seeing that these companies become so large, right? Huge companies, and Tencent, Alibaba. I think it's partly also due to President Xi's kind of a personal, his personal philosophy, that, you know, these are big companies growing very, very large. And not only they're becoming large, let me give you one example. They're also becoming a, what I say, for example, Alibaba's entire network is not just a network anymore. I would call it national infrastructure. For example, it knows what kind of things are being shipped to particular location at what time. This kind of information is very sort of sensitive, right? So basically, it's a national infrastructure. In my view, it's no different from, say, water utility, electricity grid. I mean, it's the same thing. It's a national infrastructure. So again, it's so large, so critical infrastructure that also, to some extent, concerns national security. And there are people in Beijing, invoking this argument that, you know, there's a national security perspective here, especially related to, you know, very sensitive data, that kind of things.
Yep.
So the antitrust and probably a little bit more than antitrust actions against these companies, the kind of regulations, mm-hmm. they're coming from this perspective. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite understandable because, you know, there hasn't been much done so far, and now they're taking actions. And in China, you know, I think one thing in China that we can improve is to have better communication with the public. I guess, you know, I think the government doesn't do a very good job in terms of, you know, communicating what I've been talking about here, right?
Yeah, that's true.
The policy sort of came out, and there's a lot of misunderstanding, in my view, in the West about what it really means. What's the implication of that? So I think.
By the way, I'll just say I saw that Liu He had a mm-hmm. comment or mm-hmm. speech mm-hmm. a few weeks ago mm-hmm. that made all the Chinese stocks rally.
Yeah.
When he told investors, "Listen, we understand mm-hmm. that a lot of these regulations came unnoticed, mm-hmm. surprised everyone. Nobody right. really understood what right. they're about.
Right.
It is our responsibility now to make sure that we communicate this in a better way and give you guys more predictability."
Absolutely. I think this is very important. I think this is something that the Chinese government officials can learn and do a better job about.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to the second set of issues about mm-hmm. like gaming, regulations in gaming, extracurriculum, activities, stuff like that. Yeah. I think, you know, this is actually very controversial. I think this probably also come from the very top of the government. You know, mm-hmm. There are people in the very high level of the government who strongly believe a sort of a more of a populist-oriented agenda here, social agenda here.
Yeah.
They think that too much gaming is not constructive to young people. Mm-hmm. The kind of extracurriculum activities are unfair to the rural kids, right?
It's a competition that you benefit from if you're rich, but you're disadvantaged if you're not.
Exactly. So this is much of a, you know, in my view, it's very much a social justice populist agenda. I think the better politically correct word is people-centered.
Yeah.
People-centered agenda. Yeah.
Or how the phrase that was commonly used recently and is a term from Deng Xiaoping's days is common prosperity.
Yeah.
Saying that basically she says what Deng talked about is, okay, first we need to make sure that we have the economy marching forward and that everything is progressing and that we have enough wealth. But mm-hmm. once we do, we need to make sure that we take care of common prosperity so that everyone benefit from the economic rise of China.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is framed as under this initiative, let's say.
Exactly. Deng Xiaoping actually said both, but over the years, people didn't pay attention to the second part. They just look at the first part, let people get rich first, right?
Yeah.
They didn't really talk about the second part. Now I think, you know, President Xi is saying that it's about time to look at the second part. Okay, I think that's where he's coming from. So it's very much a people-driven, people-centered agenda, trying to benefit the mass, the relatively, you know, less privileged people. Mm-hmm. It's mostly coming from that perspective.
And that also relates to some of the things that you've mentioned in the previous part when we talked about, because some of that common prosperity goals, you referred to the regulation as really also a national security issue. But more than that, I think that it's also a matter of really there is a wish to help the small and medium business and enterprises to have more fair competition and be in a situation where they can, of course, it's hard to compete against Alibaba, right?
You hit the nail right on the head. You know, Alibaba's business, I would say, destroyed a lot of small businesses. Just like, I think it's very similar to the 1970s in the United States when Walmart came to place, right? Walmart destroyed so many mom and pop retail outlets in small towns, in small cities.
Yeah.
It And I think today the digital platforms are doing exactly the same thing. I mean, they came along, they destroyed a lot of small mom and pop type of retail outlets, and a lot of people are complaining about this. So yeah. There's political pressure. I'm trying to do something about it.
It loses some of the charm, you know, of going into your local shop and so on. But the question rises is if this is purely something that is like idealistic or romantic, or is there an economic sense into going after this kind of a strategy?
You're asking a very tough question, actually. If I wear my economist hat, okay,
yeah.
I would point to the evidence, empirical evidence, that ask this question, whether the Walmart phenomenon has benefited U.S. economy, right, in the 1970s, 1980s. It's very difficult to refute that argument, actually, right? I mean, it's extremely efficient model, you know, it streamlines supply chain, it brings the prices down, and of course, it destroys a lot of jobs, but you know, we economists tend to have a sort of a systematic view of this. I mean, the jobs destroyed, for every job destroyed, there are more jobs being created, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you look at the U.S. economy today, you know, the unemployment rate is actually very low.
Right.
So, and I would argue, you know, every time there's a this kind of a revolutionary new technology came around, history has never failed us, have never failed human beings for creating new jobs, for jobs lost.
Right.
If you look at every stage of the economic development in history, you know, that's always the case. So, you know, of course, there are winners and losers. I mean, the losers are those people who kind of are very difficult to adjust for a new career. They're, you know, in their 40s and 50s, and they can find it very difficult to pick up new things to make a living. I mean, it's a very difficult situation, I would say. From an economist's perspective, you know, I refer to the Walmart example, you know. So you ask me, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, I think that probably in the short run, it's going to be painful for a lot of people. But I think in the long run, we'll be fine, you know. The technology development is unstoppable. It's difficult to try to fight against it.
I fully agree. And I think really I always try personally to look at this as something that, you know, it's an equation with many parameters, right? And in the end, when you look at this, is of course, you know, there are jobs created versus jobs lost, and there is the price and versus the salaries that people get, because, you know, there are jobs, but the question is also how much they pay and how can you live from it. But then there is also the question of, if you know, it's not like, at least the way that I see it, it's not like China government and reform now is trying to say, okay, Alibaba has no place to exist with its e-commerce business anymore. It says Alibaba can do that, but that means that the merchants on the Alibaba e-commerce platforms need to be able to make a fair living, need to be able to make sure that they can sell both on the Alibaba platform and on competing platforms and without getting any penalties or getting a very high take rate taken from them, and try to create something that uses these massive, innovative, very impressive platforms, but in a way that serves the greater good rather than just the stakeholders.
I give you an example, a perfect example. I was actually involved in a recent lawsuit against Alibaba for something like this. In China's anti-monopoly law, there's Article 17, what's called the abuse of dominance, market dominance. Alibaba used to have a practice. Let me tell you, Alibaba used to have a practice. In other words, if as a retailer, you're trying to sell something on Alibaba's platform and you try to open another outlet and another platform, they can sometimes try to shut you down, actually. In other words, they will tell you, not explicitly, but sort of in a very subtle way, saying that, well, you know, if you like the other platform so much, you can just move over, you know? So it's basically, what's called an exclusionary practice, right?
Right.
So, this is a practice, in my view, is already being outlawed. I mean, not through legislative means, but through government decree. Through government decree, you cannot do that. I think this is a perfect example to illustrate the point you're making, right? In other words, even though, you know, these are big platforms, we still let them to operate, But we have to have certain rules and regulations in place to protect the interests of the small guys, right? So, that's a good example in my view.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point. Thank you for highlighting that.
Sure.
And another question that I have about that is that, again, we talked about the economic reasoning behind doing things like that. There's an argument I heard and found interesting, and maybe you can shed some more light on how accurate that is. But I saw people referring to what's called the middle income trap, mm-hmm. saying that China is sort of in a risk that it would be stuck, quote unquote, in the middle income trap. So it won't be able to make the next leap to a high income economy per household, of course. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to make sure that it can make that leap is to create a better consumer spending out of the pie.
Right.
And to enable more businesses to flourish, more small and medium businesses to flourish, and that all the regulation that's trying to help with these two things is basically recently with the anti-monopolistic practices and with supporting small and medium businesses is also in a greater strategy of trying to build strong foundation to leap over that middle income trap.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The middle income trap is something the government is very concerned about, particularly in reference to some examples in South America and Central America, like economies like Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina, these economies. And I think one thing you mentioned very well, in other words, the country cannot just exclusively rely on its strong performance of export sector.
Yeah.
It has to, the domestic consumption side has to step up.
Yeah.
You know, China's a very large economy. It cannot be like the 19th century, the British Empire. You know, it's very much a sort of a global trading nation. And we're going to run into many, many political problems around the world if the country is going down that path. So domestic economy is very important. Consumption is very important. So that's one piece. The second piece is really about innovation in terms of raising productivity. This is also one area the government is paying a lot of attention. They're pumping a lot of money into R&D, for example, support innovation activities.
A lot of incentives for company to increase their R&D expenditure in the right directions.
Exactly. And also a lot of VC activities. I mean, the venture capital activities in China is actually very vibrant. I mean, I have several friends in that space. And actually, they told me, say, John, you're going to Israel, you find some good companies, let us know.
We were talking about the VC, the very vibrant VC industry in China. Mm-hmm. That is really exceptional. And I track it very closely and all the activities there. And it's really very impressive. I read, by the way, last year, a great book by Kai-Fu Lee, who manages Sinovation Ventures, which is brilliant. And some of the numbers that he just throw there, you know, as an example of, you know, the competition between the VCs and how many VCs you have, like, for example, just in Haidian in Beijing or places like that.
Right.
It's really exceptional. It really helped build a lot of great companies in the last decade.
Right.
So, that's also something that would really... from what I understand from your point is that this is something that will also help China leap over that middle income trap.
Right.
And that really leads us to another interesting point. In the last 5-year plan, and you could also see this in the last two sessions from last year and this year.
Oh, you're really familiar with politics in China.
Doing my best. But what you saw that was exceptional is that the goal was not anymore grow as fast as you can. It was much more about the quality of growth and the areas that we want to use as the locomotives, let's say, that push the economy forward in the future, compared to the past where it was just like very aggressive growth targets, 8%, 10%, things like that. Now you see that it's been reduced, I would say, almost to the minimum possible to keep supporting, you know, the jobs creation and things that you need. And there's much more focus into the quality of the growth, where it's coming from, how it's reached, and through what industries. So do you see that really as something that tries to play to that innovation promotion that you've mentioned, or is it a matter of other circumstances?
You're absolutely right, actually. I totally agree with you. In economics, we have this theory called convergence theory. In other words, developing economies tend to grow pretty fast compared to developed economies, but eventually, you know, as developed countries become more and more like developed countries, the growth rate is also going to be more or less the same. Today, in a developed world, you have an annual growth rate of 3%. It's called growth, right?
Yeah.
It's got a very
good
actually.
Growth.
Yeah, good growth. Yeah, exactly. For countries like Japan, UK, I mean, they've been hovering around 1% for many, many years, right?
Yeah.
So inevitably, China will be like that sooner or later.
Yeah.
If you look at the growth numbers in the last, I would say, 10 years, I think starting from 2012, ever since I think from 2012, if I remember this correctly, the annual growth rate has been coming down year after year.
Yeah.
Every year there's a drop.
Yeah.
And I think we are... It's not that we're not doing well. It's just that we're becoming more like the United States, I would say. We're getting to the 5% territory. I think the 6%, 7% is behind us for good. We'll never be able to get to that stage anymore because we're already very big, right? It's already big. And getting a 6% growth rate out of today's China's economy is tremendously difficult. I think somebody said it's like creating another Australian economy every year or something like that, right? So it's extremely difficult. So I think we're getting to the 5% territory in the next 5 years for sure. And after that, it's probably in the 4% territory.
Interesting.
So that's one thing. And I would say the second thing is that the quality of growth is really coming from again from President Xi. I mean, he's talking about, for example, environment protection. That's
yeah.
very dear to his heart. That's part of quality growth. He's talking about access to medical care,
yeah.
Access to fair education, for example. All these things are part of the metrics that measure quality growth. Affordable housing is another thing, for example. So these things are something that are very personal to him. We have
yeah.
to understand, President Xi is very personally quite emotional about these issues, poverty alleviation and all these things.
Yeah,
people-centered agenda.
The flag that he raises, for his presidency.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So these are the things he emphasized a lot, and I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's about time to address these issues. I would say in today's
yeah.
Chinese society, we've been pretty much like out in the Wild West, growing like crazy for many years. And together with it, inevitably, there's going to be a set of problems, right? So he's trying to address these things. Full security, full safety, for example, is another
yeah.
big issue, right? Full safety, environmental protection, a slew set of issues, not just relevant to the rich people, but also very much relevant to the middle class and the less privileged as well.
I agree. And by the way, we see it now, because of the war in the Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
that you see that suddenly food security is become an issue
yeah.
globally.
Right.
And I think that pretty much the only company in the world
yeah.
that is well prepared for an extreme scenario like this is China. Or let's say, I don't know if you can say well prepared for a scenario like this anyway, but let's say much better than the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And this is something that you see, that this kind of mindset that is, it's pretty unique to China, and Matan mentioned this in the episode when I spoke to him about the importance that the Chinese leaders have to the fact that there would be a bowl of rice for every person in the country, no matter what, something so fundamental
mm-hmm.
that in the West, a lot of time, this is overlooked already.
It's taken
for granted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think people who are... my generation, for example, we still have memories of, I would say near starvation in the 1970s,
yeah.
right? So, food is meager. And I still have memories when I was a little boy, beggars who would wait outside our my mother's school's cafeteria, waiting us for us to finish, and then they would just rush in to pick up the rest. I mean, that kind of a scene still in my memory. So I think the current leaders, they're probably a little bit older than I am, and we're probably more or less the same generation. These people, they are brought up from that kind of a background, and they take these issues seriously. I would also add a note that the situation in Ukraine, my conjecture is that there actually will be more people dying outside of Ukraine than inside of Ukraine as a result of the current development, precisely because of the issue you mentioned, the food shortage, the high-flying prices of agricultural products. And that's very unfortunate.
Definitely. It's the kind of things that one specific situation can cause so many domino effect like consequences for places that are not really related to what happened there directly, but indirectly they would suffer from it. That's true. So that's very, very interesting and very important point to mention. And I also want us to discuss, when you talked about innovation and the future of the Chinese economy, I thought it was fascinating to hear from you that, you think that the times of 6-7% that's history, and 5%, and from here it will probably go down to 4 and 3. It will take time. It will be gradual, but this is the inevitable direction. And the question is, because one thing that I think that the Chinese government is doing in a way that I think is fascinating is their whole view on data, digitization and automation of the economy, and really looking at data as a mean of production and as a something that would be translated into a lot of real value from the digital economy. And that's something that I find fascinating, and I would like to hear what is your view on this matter.
Yeah, there's a lot of theory about data is gold, data is oil, oil, right? So absolutely, data is something that's very important in the digital economy. And for the Chinese economy, the data is viewed as perceived as an advantage because we have a lot of data.
Yep.
Because we have a lot of people. so we are real big data. Speaking of big data.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And everyone is using everything digitally. Like we said, digital payments, digital wallets.
Exactly. And there are actually a couple of other more interesting perspectives. I would say, let me raise another very strong difference. Like in the United States, privacy protection is taken very seriously, right?
Yeah.
Now, in China, we don't have this kind of a legislation or legal protection. So I would say the usage of private data is definitely more intensive and extensive than, for example, the United States. Is this an advantage or disadvantage? Well, depends on what perspective you're coming from, what side you are on, right?
And this is also something that China tries to regulate now with the PIPL law and things like that.
Well, they're trying to introduce some measures for consumer protection, but I think there's a big gap between the two countries. Another interesting perspective or difference is that this is actually quite interesting. Is that a lot of people in China are atheist, whereas in the United States, what they call a nation of faith, right? It's a nation of faith.
Yeah.
So people have strong convictions in countries like these about developments of, for example, AI. AI is very much built on, using data, right? So I think the innovations in towards that direction can be potentially quite conservative. Whereas in countries where people are mostly atheists, they don't have that constraint, right? They can move very rapidly, and they're very audacious in advancing along that front. So I think that's another quite important and big difference.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. I didn't really think about it from that angle, but that's true. And When we look at data, though, now in China, one thing that I found really intriguing, and I think that it's a model that the West would probably at least learn from, if not copy, let's say, is the whole view of data as a financial asset. And the fact that now they're basically stock exchange, like stock exchanges, but data exchanges, bourses and things like that. This is pretty revolutionary idea. And when we think about also when we relate it to some of the things that we discussed about before, like, for example, the opportunity for smaller companies to compete with the huge companies that we mentioned before, like Alibaba and Tencent, that in addition to everything, they also control most of the data. And they have a huge advantage on everything that it's AI related because of
Absolutely. That. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. This is certainly not a level playing field. I mean, the big companies, they have the scale, they have that, they control the data. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier for them to come up with new applications, new technologies. I think it would be interesting to observe in the future, you know, this sort of battle between the manufacturing side, which has a lot of small companies, mm-hmm. with these big platform companies. We're starting to see more and more the commercial model of manufacturing starting to change. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are many companies in China today, for example, they don't have warehouses at all. The stuff they ship to the platform comes warehouses. Mm-hmm. The orders come from them. They manufacture things according to the orders. Right? Yeah. So there's obviously a battle over who's controlling this, right? So I would say the platform side has a lot of advantages. You know, they have the data, they have the customers, they have the scale. I think that's just where the government policy can come into play. I mean, this is where I think the one area where I would say the market probably is fading to some extent, not fading entirely, but fading to some extent. Yeah. The antitrust stuff is precisely where the policy can be used to somehow level the playing field in the interest of small, medium-sized businesses. We don't want to, after all, China, I would say, still is very much a, at least politically speaking, still very much a sort of a socialist country, right? Even though, free market ownership, private ownership has grown tremendously over the years, but politically, it's still very much a socialist country. There's this political constraint that big business cannot go that far.
Absolutely. And to me, I think that it's interesting because in the end, all these big tech companies that control all the data and branch into more and more fields, it's not just a Chinese phenomenon, obviously. If you look at Alibaba and Tencent, they're in a pretty similar position to what you would see Amazon or Google or Facebook do in the U.S.
Right.
And then this model that China came up with, and again, it's in baby steps from what I understand. Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't been to China myself in over 2 years. But from what I understand right now, there are already first data exchanges that are operating, but mm-hmm. they're really kind of like as a beta phase, let's say, where there are mainly government companies that provide data sets, but the fact that, if you say, okay, all the data that Alibaba and Tencent and companies like this and all the other big companies, for example, they can have this, they can collect this data because obviously they do that by operating their platform. Mm-hmm. But then there are some laws about how they can use it, how they can benefit from it, which type of law is data is personal, which one is sensitive to national security, and all the rest of it make it into data sets that can be in a way licensed or have a clear market set price, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's the right way to say it. That you can associate with it, and that means first of all that the small companies can benefit from it and use it, and even the government can decide that for smaller startups, like you invest capital, you invest data, you give them data to mm-hmm. build great things.
Right.
But on the other hand, it helps all these big companies that get all this data to get some sort of compensation for the fact that it's not just becoming public data that everyone can use freely, but they get compensated in a fair market set price for it.
It's a monetizing mechanism. It's a fair market-based monetizing mechanism. You're absolutely right, actually. I don't view these set of issues as sort of, you know, belonging to the ideological debate. I mean, United States has this kind of a problem, as you said, you know, there's big tech companies, and the government is also taking antitrust, the Justice Department is also taking antitrust actions, investigations against these companies. Yeah. The same is true in China as well. So I would say it's a common problem. It's a common problem brought about by technology, by the, you know, the movement towards the digital economy. And we all face this problem. They probably have some more things in common. The two competition authorities, respectively in China and the United States, can talk about these things.
I agree. This is why I think really the view that China has on this, and I don't know how it will materialize again, because it's right now more a concept than something that happens in practice. But I think that if this proves to be efficient and effective, it can be a solution that basically, instead of creating regulation that handicap these companies, kind of just makes or creates a different way of operating that doesn't make the data a monopoly that they own, but still let them benefit from the fact that they created it. Right. And I think that this is something that could be applied in other countries very easily. So it would be interesting to see how this develops. Yeah. This is personally something that I found fascinating and try to research. Can't wait to see how this is materializing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
Absolutely. So Professor Gong, first of all, time flew in such an interesting conversation. I feel like we could have keep talking for hours. But I want to, first of all, thank you a lot again for coming here today. And also before we finish, just ask you if there is any specific recommendation or anything that you would like to share to our listeners in terms of, can be anything from personal recommendation, things you like, things you, a good book that you read, resources of information. One thing that I can say, of course, is, again, we said in the beginning of the conversation, is UIB Israel, for students that are looking into understanding the Chinese business and economy right now, but like you mentioned also in other fields to come, obviously that's really an exceptional venture. But in addition to that, is there anything else?
First of all, thank you very much. Really, it's a great pleasure to have this conversation. Love to do it more in the future, I guess.
Our pleasure.
In terms of what else I can say, I'm very grateful for the opportunity for our university to be able to operate here in Israel. So if there's any chance, I would really appreciate our listeners would come to our website. You can Google UIB Israel very easily.
Absolutely.
take a look at our website. Other than that, I would say, I really wish peace in Israel. I think this is extremely important because, we're going to bring a lot of Chinese students. You know, I don't know if people in Israel know that. There's a lot of misunderstanding and misconception about Israel in China. So, for example, when I talk to my friends about coming to Israel, they say, oh, why are you going there? Isn't there war always going on over there?
Yeah.
They have no idea about, you know, how peaceful and how nice it is here in Tel Aviv. But still, you know, there are those things still happen, right? Just in the last few weeks. And these things go back to China and, you know, people sort of reinforced with this idea that it's not safe over there.
Yeah.
So I think if anything that I would wish for Israel is that there would be peace in Israel, that people are free from this sort of extreme radical thinking that would enable them to sort of fight against each other. So that's my biggest wish for Israel. Put it this way.
Thank you very much. I joined that wish, and really I think that, you know, like you said, a lot of time, like what I try to do, you know, with the podcast, some of the content here is really to help the audience in Israel to see China beyond the media filter that they usually get. And I think it's a very similar situation to how Israel is portrayed all over the world, basically, but also in China.
Yeah.
you get only the bad news, right?
Yeah,
you get
exactly.
only nobody tells you, oh, it's not a news in China if it was a beautiful sunny day in Tel Aviv and everybody went to the beach and had a good time, right? It's
yeah,
news
exactly.
only if there is violence or yeah. So thank you very much for that wishing, Professor Gong, and thank you again for coming here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And hope to have you again next time. There's still so much to discuss.
With pleasure. With pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
אז חברים, תודה רבה שהגעתם עד כאן. אם נהניתם, נשמח אם תדרגו את הפודקאסט בפלטפורמה שבה אתם שומעים אותו, תשתפו אותו עם חברות וחברים, שנראה לכם שעשויים למצוא אותו מעניין. אתם מוזמנים לבקר באתר של להבין את סין, להצטרף לקבוצת הפייסבוק שלנו, או לערוץ הטלגרם, בשביל לקבל עדכונים יומיומיים על מדינת המרכז. ואם אתם רוצים להזין לפודקאסטים נוספים בנושאי פיננסים והשקעות, אני מזמין אתכם להאזין לפודקאסטים של רשת אינבסטור 360. שוב, המון תודה לפרופסור ג'ון גונג שהיה איתנו כאן היום. אני מקווה שנהניתם מהשיחה. אני יובל ויינרב. תודה רבה גם לשם הפודקאסטים ויצירות סאונד על ההפקה, ולשי קלוט הנהדרת שליוותה אותנו כאן באולפן היום. ותודה רבה לכם על ההאזנה. עד הפעם הבאה, צאי ג'י.
מוזמנים להזין לפודקאסטים נוספים שלנו, המשקיענים, השקעות למתחילים, אינבסטור לייב וכסף חדש.
הופק ונערך על ידי שמע, פודקאסטים ויצירות סאונד.